Welcome to Statewide, Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor discusses a family memoir.
I don't remember him ever smiling. I don't remember him ever talking. Rarely speaking. My grandfather did not survive the Holocaust, even though he was alive.
We'll have more on the book Escape from Dachau. That's on the way. We'll also look at crime in Chicago and concerns about some of Donald Trump's policies that activists say could make things worse. We'll try to dispel some myths about vaccines. Also, more on Central Illinois Congresswoman Mary Miller. The Republican hopes to leverage Trump's win to push back against transgender policies. And we'll hear why more farmers are adding strips of prairie to their fields. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Agriculture replaced nearly all the original prairie in the Midwest, but a growing number of farmers are incorporating strips of prairie into their row crop fields. The colorful corridors help with soil and water quality and wildlife. And as Rachel Kramer with Harvest Public Media reports, there are efforts underway to expand the use of prairie strips.
In a wide gap between two cornfields, Lee Tesdell points out native grasses like big bluestem and wildflowers.
Here's another one. This is wild quinine.
We're in a prairie strip. Here, it's around 40 feet wide, roughly the size of a county highway. This line of native perennials stretches to the horizon.
To a conventional farmer, this looks like a weed patch with a few pretty flowers in it. And I admit it looks odd in the corn soy landscape that we have in central Iowa.
Tesdell has three prairie strips on his century farm. One reason is to help protect his soil from strong winds and heavy bursts of rain, which are becoming more frequent.
I'm trying to be more climate change resilient on my farm.
Research shows that converting as little as 10% of a corn or soybean field into a prairie strip can reduce soil erosion by 95%. Above ground, the prairie strip's wall of stems act like a speed bump for runoff. Below ground, their extensive roots anchor layers of soil and absorb excess water. Prairie strips also keep nutrients like nitrates and phosphorus in fields and out of drinking water, and they provide critical habitat for pollinators and grassland birds, like this Dick Sissel. The conservation practice got its start at Iowa State University about two decades ago. Lisa Schulte Moore was a big part of that. During a recent outreach event, the landscape ecologist and 2021 MacArthur Fellow says large patches of prairie are vital, but
we've done research to really solidly show that a little bit of prairie, you know, can do a lot, right?
Schulte Moore credits early adopters and partners across the Midwest for helping prairie strips gain traction, but she says a monumental shift happened with the 2018 Farm Bill. That's when they were added to the Conservation Reserve Program. Nearly 23,000 acres of prairie strips across 14 states are enrolled. Landowners like Doug Doty get annual payments for taking vulnerable land out of production. He converted 16 acres of his north central Missouri farm into prairie strips in February.
So it's a little bit ugly this year, a lot of weeds growing up.
But Doty says it will get prettier with time. He knows this because over the last decade, he's turned several hundred acres of highly erodible ground into prairie. Doty says his conservation strategy makes financial sense and improves downstream water quality. He doesn't understand why more farmers aren't taking action to keep valuable nutrients in their fields.
And when cattle break through the fence or a gate is left open, we have a sense of urgency to get those cattle back in and fix the fence, right?
But there's a cap on the number of acres that can go into CRP.
So I think the intention of USDA dollars to adopt conservation at scale is really great, but voluntary conservation has its limits.
Omar DeCook Mercado worked on CRP policy as part of the Iowa State Prairie Strips research team. Now he's with a Colorado-based nonprofit. MAD Agriculture helps conventional farmers transition to regenerative ag practices like prairie strips.
They're climactically adapted in the Midwest to thrive. So it's a low-hanging fruit, essentially, on a farm. To bring in prairie on a Midwestern farm is a path of least resistance to incorporate biodiversity.
Mad Ag and Whole Foods Market recently launched a pilot program with 4 farms across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Montana to cover the initial costs of prairie strips and provide on-the-ground support. Back at Iowa State, Lisa Schulte Moore is also looking at the economics to scale up prairie strips. Someday soon, she hopes more corn and soybean fields will keep some color after harvest.
I dream of driving across Iowa winter and seeing various shades of greens and yellows and oranges rather than brown.
Those colors would reflect at least a small return of the prairie that once flourished across the Midwest. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
Some say vaccines are a victim of their own success because vaccines have been so effective at eradicating some of the most dangerous diseases. Most of us have never actually experienced what it's like to live in a world where you can get diseases like measles at the grocery store, or where your child can get polio and possibly be paralyzed. It's sometimes hard to comprehend that, especially with a lot of misconceptions about vaccines floating around. Side Effects Public Media's Lizzie McGreevy talked to the managing editor, Farah Yousri, to tackle some of the popular vaccine misconceptions.
So we're going to cover some kind of heavy topics today, such as vaccination. So I was thinking we could gamify this episode a little bit and have our first ever game of True or False, the checkup edition. What do you think about that?
I love it.
Okay, perfect. So basically what's going to happen is I'm going to state a claim and you are going to say whether that claim is true or false and then give us an explanation with science and data and all of that stuff to back it up. Sound good?
Yep.
Okay. So for the first claim, and this is a big one, true or false, vaccines cause autism.
False. So, in the late 90s, a British doctor called Andrew Wakefield made the claim that the combination of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, also known as the MMR vaccine, caused autism. To quote-unquote prove it, he published a case series of children, 8 of whom developed autism within a month of getting the vaccine. That was it. Now, this study was discredited and retracted, and really, it did not support the claim that vaccines cause autism, and did not prove any cause and effect relation whatsoever. Listen to what Dr. Robert Frank told me. He's one of the country's top vaccine experts and the director of the Center for Vaccine Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He says, by virtue of how many children got the measles vaccine around the world, the vaccine can really be associated with nearly anything.
Over 90% of kids got measles vaccine. So measles vaccine is going to be associated with everything, right? Because everybody got it. So you could say measles vaccine is associated with you eating breakfast tomorrow morning.
So the only way to scientifically establish a cause and effect and to test that claim is to look at large numbers of children who either did or didn't get that vaccine and make sure you control for things like socioeconomic background, medical background, so that you can isolate the effect of that one specific variable, which is getting the MMR vaccine. Listen to what Dr. Paul Offit told me. He's a leading expert in virology and immunology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
And when you did that study, and it's been done 18 times in 7 countries on 3 continents, involving hundreds of thousands of children and costing tens of millions of dollars, you are not at greater risk of getting autism if you got that vaccine or not. But I just think that it's hard to unring the bell. Once you've raised a safety concern, it's very hard to make it go away, especially for a disorder like autism, for which there isn't a clear cause, there isn't a clear cure. So you're looking for something.
Fascinating. Thank you, Farah. Next claim, true or false, diseases like measles or polio are not even in the U.S. anymore, so it's unnecessary to vaccinate my child against them.
False, and that's a very interesting one. So those diseases are nearly gone from the U.S., but it would be a stretch to say that they do not exist in the U.S. anymore. In fact, as recently as 2 years ago, there was a polio case in New Jersey, and we hear about measles outbreaks in schools in several states all the time. Bottom line is, as you know, you can travel almost anywhere in the world and be back in under 24 hours. So some of these diseases are still out there in the world, and they can very easily be brought back into the U.S. So being vaccinated is still necessary and protects you from some horrible diseases.
So here's the next claim. I am at my doctor's office and they're asking me to give my child multiple shots at the same time. Surely my child's system will be overloaded, right?
That's a good one, and it's not true. And here's why. The number of antigens that multiple vaccines introduce to the body is extremely minimal compared to the number of antigens that children are exposed to since the day they are born. Now, we're talking about, you know, colds, kids playing in the dirt, you know, eating sand. And, you know, here's how Dr. Offit put it.
A single bacterium, you know, has about 3,000 immunological components, and you're colonized with trillions of them. If we couldn't survive the immunological challenge of vaccines, we wouldn't survive as a species. I mean, we encounter vaccines are literally, not figuratively, literally a drop in the ocean of what we encounter and manage every day.
True or false, herd immunity and natural immunity are just as effective or even more effective than vaccines.
Lizzie, let me ask you this. How do you get herd immunity or natural immunity?
I'm going to guess by getting infected by the disease.
Exactly. So it kind of becomes like Russian roulette. You're rolling the dice and hoping that if your child gets a disease, their body is going to survive it and not suffer severe short or long-term damage or even death. One way experts say you can think about vaccines is kind of like a software update to your cell phone. It helps your child's immune system stay updated to be able to fight germs. So one example Dr. Offit gave me is measles. If you're infected with measles, measles will reproduce itself in your body thousands and thousands of times. It can cause horrible problems, up to death. Now, when you get the vaccine, which is a weakened version of measles, it will only reproduce itself 10, 15, or 20 times in your body and then stop. So you only get to experience some side effects a few days later.
Thank you so much for this valuable information, Farah. And I'm getting something breaking in right now. Oh, yes, we have the winner of today's true or false quiz. And that is everyone, because winning is the knowledge we gain along the way. And maybe someday they will make a vaccine that will make me less cheesy.
That's Side Effects Public Media's community engagement specialist, Lizzie McGreevy. And she talked with the managing editor, Farah Yousry, about vaccines. A central Illinois lawmaker hopes to leverage one of Donald Trump's key campaign promises to push against progressive transgender policies. Republican Mary Miller represents Illinois' sprawling 15th congressional district. She spoke in Washington as part of a panel discussion on what a group of conservative lawmakers calls the dangers of gender ideology. Miller promotes family involvement in K-12 education, and she also co-chairs the fledgling Congressional Family Caucus. Lauren Warnicke has more.
Our goal is to get a dedicated group of representatives in the House committed to finding policy solutions to protect and promote the fundamental building block of any healthy society, which is the family.
In Illinois, schools may not require a legal name change or change of gender on a student's birth certificate to update school records. They also need not seek parental consent to affirm a child's transgender identity. Miller voted last year to help narrowly pass a parent's bill of rights in the House of Representatives that would have required schools to disclose policies on sex-specific spaces and activities. The Democratic majority in the Senate did not bring it up for a vote.
If we want thriving communities, the schools and the parents need to work together. Parents need to be in the driver's seat of everything.
Miller has also backed two congressional bills aimed at banning gender transition procedures for minors.
And then also protecting the rights of pediatricians and child psychologists who refuse to provide gender-affirming care, and for whistleblowers that are exposing doctors that are breaking the law.
Republican Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas led the panel. He was an obstetrician before joining the Senate.
I took care of many pre-adolescent girls, and they came in with different problems, and I always told the mom, let's try to get through this without any scar tissue. There's some things that are irreversible, and like pregnancy is irreversible and STDs are irreversible. But here today, we're protecting young lady and men from genital mutilation, because that's what this is.
Terry Schilling is president of the right-leaning American Principles Project. A report characterizing what he calls the gender industrial complex estimates U.S. pharmaceutical companies and medical providers have made more than $4 billion on transgender care.
Part of what today's all about is talking about how much money is getting made by this industry. And it is an industry. It's not a civil rights movement. But also, how are we going to move forward to protect children?
Paula Scanlon is a former University of Pennsylvania swimmer. She is an ambassador for the Independent Women's Voice. That's an organization that opposes the inclusion of transgender women in women's sports. Scanlon was a teammate of Leah Thomas, the first openly transgender athlete to win an NCAA Division I national championship. Scanlon says her school's administration did not allow female swimmers to oppose Thomas's participation on their team.
They sat us down. They said, "You're hateful and horrible. If you ever speak out against this, you will spend the rest of your life regretting it. You'll be on the wrong side of history." And the last thing that they told us was they said, "If you still object with everything we've said so far, please seek psychological help." And they gave us the number for an on-campus counselor.
Transgender rights advocates say bans on participation further stigmatize a group that is already marginalized. The Human Rights Campaign says a flurry of legislation proposed by conservative state and federal lawmakers is rooted in misinformation and stereotypes. Bree Byers represents the Queer Coalition at Illinois State University.
I think mostly it's just a fear of an unknown people, because transgender people don't make up a lot of America. Not a whole lot of the average American personally knows a transgender person.
Swimmer Leah Thomas has been barred from competition beyond the collegiate level. President-elect Donald Trump made a trans athlete ban a hallmark of his campaign. Here's Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, a former collegiate football coach.
The American people are sick of this nonsense. That's why they overwhelmingly, and one of the big reasons, people voted to send Donald Trump back to the White House.
In April, the Biden administration expanded Title IX protections against sex discrimination to include transgender people. The law took effect August 1st. Legal challenges have blocked enforcement in 26 states. Donald Trump could reverse Biden's executive action when he takes office in January, but Miller and other Republican lawmakers see an opportunity to roll back those changes through legislation.
Now we have control of the House and the Senate. And the White House, well, we have a majority in the House and the Senate and control of the White House, so we have literally no excuse not to pass this.
In August, the Supreme Court rejected the Biden administration's request to enforce the new Title IX rules in states with pending lawsuits. The Illinois Department of Human Rights requires that schools allow students who are transgender, non-binary, or gender non-conforming to participate in school activities consistent with their gender identity. I'm Lauren Warnicke.
Just ahead, a Holocaust memoir that's on the way on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Kathy Mueller Slonim wrote a memoir about her father's escape from a German work camp, Dachau, in 1938, but didn't want it published until after her death. She died in 2021, and her three children worked to get that memoir printed. Escape from Dachau, a true story of survival courage and a daring escape in the face of unthinkable evil, was released last year. Maureen McKinney interviewed Slonim's daughter, Susan Service, about the book.
If you could tell me why your mother didn't want to publish the story in her lifetime, because writing it must have been incredibly painful in the first place.
That is exactly why my brother, sister, and I think she did not want to. First of all, you have to remember that not a word of what happened to my mom and my grandparents and their families during the Holocaust was ever spoken. Starting in the 1960s, the German government, various cities had invited former German citizens to return to Germany. It was a program called Return of the Lost Citizens. My mom refused to go. She never wanted to step foot on German soil again. But in the year 2000, my brother, sister, and I thought it would be good closure for my mom to go. So my mom wrote to the mayor of Stuttgart, where the invitation came from, and said, "I will go." And my mom said, "I will go if I can bring my daughter and my 16-year-old granddaughter so that three generations can dance on Hitler's grave." Now, of course, we know Hitler wasn't buried in Germany, but it was the philosophical thing that she was willing to go if three generations could go back and say, "Here we are." So my mom took that trip, and there were 20 survivors on that particular day, that particular trip. And as everyone else started telling their stories and started telling what happened to them, all of a sudden my mom opened up and was telling her memoir that I had never heard, that my, you know, my family, my daughter, no one had heard. And when we got back to the United States, she wrote it down. I understand why she wanted us not to do anything with it until she passed, because as you and I are speaking now, I have gotten a lot of requests from all over the world to talk about this event, this memoir, what happened. It's very hard to continue to think about the details of what went on and what my grandfather and grandmother and my mom experienced. So I understand why she did not want to do that. My grandfather refused to leave Germany. And by the time he woke up to what was really going on, they could not get out. But you have to remember that the Jews over the centuries were loyal and committed German citizens. They were not only doctors, lawyers, engineers, and architects, but they contributed to art and music and technology. And, you know, my grandfather served for Germany in World War I, as did most of my grandmother's brothers. And my grandmother and her sisters volunteered for the German Red Cross during World War I. So my grandfather refused to believe that anything bad would happen to them because they were so committed and such loyal Germans. He had a successful manufacturing business that actually used the technology established in the U.S. by Henry Ford. He was very successful. He had a lot of friends. His customers loved him. They didn't leave, as many Jews, starting in the early 30s, once Hitler came to power in 1933, they started to leave. One of my grandmother's brothers came to the United States very early. Other brothers went to Luxembourg and Belgium, but they got out of Germany, but my grandfather refused to leave. In 1936, my mom was thrown out of her public school because Jews were no longer allowed to attend public school. And it was at that time, 36, where the brown shirts started roaming the streets, harassing and beating innocent Jews, putting swastikas on businesses and homes. And in 1938, they took my grandfather's business, his car, his home, everything. And of course, now America had closed her doors to more Jewish immigrants. So Jews were desperately trying to go elsewhere, Argentina, Israel, other countries in Europe, wherever they could go. But it was very hard at that point to get out of Germany, and they weren't allowed to leave Germany. And of course, November 9th, 1938, Kristallnacht, when they started burning down Jewish synagogues and homes and businesses. And then the next day, November 10th, was when my grandfather was dragged out of his home and taken to Dachau. The interesting thing about the family, my grandmother had a first cousin, Emanuel Rosenfeld. He was a mathematician. He was, you know, really brilliant in banking and math. And he worked at the largest bank in Berlin, of the Reich Bank. Schach was president of the Reich Bank, and he brought in my grandmother's first cousin as the mathematician, the banker, the numbers guy. When Hitler took power in 1933, he took Schach from the Reich Bank to become his minister of finance and economics. And who did Schach bring with him? His numbers guy, Emanuel Rosenfeld. And so Emanuel Rosenfeld, a Jew, cousin of my grandmother, actually worked in the government for the Third Reich for a very short period of time, because starting in 1934, 1935, he saw what was happening to the Jews, what Hitler's hatred and what was going on out there. And so he left his government position. He got scared. He changed his name to Max Emanuel and went into hiding. But he did one thing that was very smart. He did not get rid of his German government Third Reich identification papers that identified him as a member of the Third Reich and a government employee. He kept those papers. He applies to get out of Germany. And imagine this, the excruciating decision, because the day he got his papers to go to America, which was very rare at this point, this is now 1938, he got papers to go to the United States, and he gets a call from my grandmother's brother saying that Adolf had been taken to Dachau and he had to do something to get him out. That is the basic part of the book, Escape from Dachau, how he made this excruciating decision to risk his life and in the middle of the night drive the 500 kilometers from Berlin to Dachau to try to get his first cousin-in-law out of the concentration camp. And it's important to remember, Dachau was the first concentration camp that all the other concentration camps were modeled after. It was started as a work camp where the prisoners, doctors, lawyers, engineers, these prisoners would be making the war machines. They were making the different equipment for the war effort, but many prisoners died in Dachau. Yes, it was a work camp. It was not an extermination camp with gas chambers yet. But the way they were treated, many prisoners died. And my grandfather recalled the situation where they were brought out naked in the snow in the winter and hosed off, and that was their showers. And many prisoners died from freezing to death or the treatment that they got at Dachau.
What motivated Emmanuel to do this?
Human nature is so unpredictable. There are those that run and those that decide to be heroes, to get involved, to do what needs to be done over their own safety and life. And the one huge puzzle that I will always have about the Holocaust was the collaborators, the neighbors, the friends that turned in their Jewish friends and neighbors, the people that did not help, that did not band together to say, we are not going to tolerate this. This is outrageous. That is part of the answer to what you just asked. What motivated, at this point, Max Emmanuel to risk his life to save a cousin-in-law? He was brave. He was willing to make the sacrifice. And it's just, you know, one of the things that Escape from Dachau, the book, pays tribute to is people like him that showed true bravery, sacrifice, and resilience. What an incredible man he was. What an incredible human being he was. That trip, which is documented in the book, had to be terrifying because there were checkpoints all along the way. Now, you have to think about who are these Nazi guards at a checkpoint at 1, 2, 3 in the morning? Young Nazi soldiers who were afraid to do anything wrong because they would be taken out in the backfield and shot themselves. So when this Max Emmanuel comes through the checkpoint, scared as can be, but mustering up as much bravery as he can, and he opens his window and he hands them these documents that on the cover show that he is a government official for the Third Reich. He was passed through. And in fact, the interesting thing is no one bothered to open that packet. Because had they opened it, they would see that his name in the packet was Emmanuel Rosenfeld, clearly a Jewish name. And that would have been the end of him. They would have thought he stole the papers or whatever. So he had to get through many checkpoints to get to Dachau. And it must have been terrifying. But he was willing to take that risk.
How did he actually get your grandfather
So he arrives at the gates of Dachau, is sort of surrounded by these Nazi guards. What are you doing here? What is your business here? And again, he shows his identification and he says, bring me this Adolf Mueller, in a very strong, as strong as he can. Now, they probably thought he was going to take this prisoner and just shoot him right then and there. So he says, bring me this Adolf Mueller. And they went into the concentration camp and found my grandfather and brought him out. His cousin did not recognize him at that point. He was emaciated. He actually said, is this Adolf Mueller? Did you bring me the right prisoner? Oh, yes, this is Adolf Mueller. And then he kind of looked in my grandfather's eyes and immediately noticed this is Adolf Mueller. And he roughly put him in the car, backed out, and off they went. And basically, that's how he got him out. He just demanded that this prisoner be brought to him. He's a government official here on government business, and this prisoner has to be brought out. And it worked.
Can you tell me about the situation of your mother's family? She, her mother, and your grandfather, how did they get out of Germany?
So first, let me back up and tell you that when my grandfather was dragged off to Dachau, my grandmother brought my mom to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church hid my mother. Max Emanuel knew where my mother was. The Catholic Church, the Sisters of St. Joseph, they taught these Jewish children all of the prayers, all of the liturgy, and the Nazis would come into these Catholic churches and they would line all the kids up, Jewish and not Jewish, and they would question them. And the Jewish kids knew as much as the Catholic kids, and then they would leave. So my mom was hidden by the Catholic Church, but we know that they drove from Dachau to Stuttgart, got my grandmother, got my mom, and drove immediately to Luxembourg, where my grandmother's brother had been living for many years. That is how they got out of Germany. And in fact, a number of years later, the head of the Sisters of St. Joseph, that priest, was actually executed by the Nazis, and no reason was given, and documentation doesn't say why, but I think we know why, because he was fighting Jewish children. He also had written his memoir of what he knew, and so it's sort of a combination, but it's mostly my mom's writing and memory. Many survivors of the Holocaust went to their new countries wherever they landed, and they did very well. My grandfather never really survived. My memory of my grandfather is him staring out the living room window smoking his cigar. I don't remember him ever smiling. I don't remember him ever talking, rarely speaking. They say that it has to do with what age they were when they went through this. Younger people were more resilient, and when they got out, they did okay. My grandfather did not survive the Holocaust, even though he was alive. He seemed to me as a child to be very sad and distraught over what happened to him. His sister and her husband and their children were sent to Auschwitz and perished, were executed in Auschwitz. So he lost other members of his family.
He didn't speak of it. That is like many survivors. That
correct.
It's too terrible to talk about.
Exactly. That's right. I know that my grandmother spoke to her brother, and she probably, when they got to America or were leaving, explained things to my mom about what was going on, what was happening, why they were leaving their homeland, why all of their friends and neighbors had disappeared. But my grandfather never spoke a word.
Maureen McKinney speaking with Susan Service, daughter of the Holocaust survivor Kathy Mueller Slonim, whose memoir of her father's escape from Dachau was published posthumously and released in 2023. Illinois nursing homes that aren't meeting the state's minimum staffing levels will have to pay fines starting next year. The fine amount will depend on the daily cost of wages and benefits for missing staff hours. State law requires a minimum staffing ratio of around 4 hours per resident per day. In 2022, the governor signed into law a $700 million boost for nursing homes to increase their staffing levels. More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. School leaders from around the state are unveiling Vision 2030. It's a plan to improve learning, student safety, and attract high-quality educators in Illinois public schools. One of the recommendations is to make standardized testing more useful by providing unofficial results to school districts right after the exams end. Here's Jason Leahy. He's executive director of the Illinois Principals Association.
We're still dealing with the situation where results, you know, kids take the tests in the spring and then the results come later in the fall. And it really impacts the utility of those results and makes it difficult for us to make any real quality decisions about improving our schools and the potential outcomes for our kids.
The state recently considered overhauling elementary testing, but paused that effort and says it's not contemplating any changes now. In 2022, President Biden signed the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, or BSCA, into law. It provides community-based programs, schools, grassroots organizations, and more with funding to support efforts to keep guns out of the wrong hands, make schools safer, and expand trauma-informed mental health services in under-resourced communities. However, this funding is set to run out at the end of 2026. So what happens next, and how could efforts funded by the federal dollars be impacted? Member station WBEZ sat down with a local journalist and leader to understand how another Trump presidency might impact gun violence prevention in Chicago. Sasha Ann Simons spoke with Rita Oseguera, a reporter with The Trace, which follows gun violence across the country.
So tell us more about the Safer Communities Act. I mentioned there that it helps fund violence intervention efforts like mental health services and school safety, grassroots organizations, and red flag laws, which can limit a person's ability to buy or have a firearm. But how does the Safer Communities Act actually work in practice?
So it's an omnibus bill, so there's a lot of things in it. One of the things it has is making sure that gun dealers are regulated better, and if they're not following practices of background checks, then they can have their license removed, revoked, and making sure that they're held accountable, basically. Mm. So there's also issues around that in that law. But the main issue that people in Chicago are worried about is the funding and making sure that the programs that they have started and that they see are working on the ground continue to work.
So help us understand that overall concern then. How much of that funding comes here to Chicago?
It's a bit difficult to have an exact number because it does come from different departments. We were able to show that some millions go to CPS, is specifically for trauma-informed practices and dealing with mental health issues. And then another million go to community violence intervention programs, and that comes from a different department.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still working on a future story that can look at the specifics of where that funding went and how much money actually is going where.
Yeah, in 2022, Chicago's Metropolitan Family Services received $2 million from the DOJ's Justice Programs Community Violence Intervention and Prevention Initiative, partly funded by this legislation. And last year, CPS received $14.4 million to create a sustainable infrastructure for trauma-informed mental health services. So, yeah, it does, to your point, sort of run the gamut in how it's spread out.
Yes,
you will. There are a couple concerns that some people have here. So number one, funding being cut and that Safer Communities Act disappearing. And number two, the funds going to something else like law enforcement, as I mentioned. So why are these such big concerns, Rita? And where does the concern that the funding could be cut, where does that come from in the first place?
So the Trump administration and its spokespeople have said before that they do want to prioritize law enforcement. And to be fair, a lot of Chicagoans that I've spoken to also want to prioritize that. And you hear that with Corey Brooks, that he does want more law enforcement in areas that are hurting from gun violence.
And Corey Brooks being the founder of Project Hood.
Yes.
A local organization.
And So there are some concerns there. Some people do want to prioritize law enforcement because they want to reduce crime, and other people are worried that law enforcement might exacerbate the problem and cause more incarceration, which then cause the ripping apart of families, which then cause another cycle of violence all over again. You have children that might not be raised by their parents, and then the cycle just continues. So some people are really worried about that focus in law enforcement because of that.
So you spoke with three local leaders, as I alluded to earlier. You wanted to get their thoughts on how the result of this election could affect these programs. So you talked with UChicago trauma surgeon Dr. Tanya Zacherson, Southside Violence Prevention Organization Project Hood's founder Corey Brooks, and Chicago's Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, or CCPSA's 24th District Counselor Veronica Ariola, who we're going to hear from in just a few minutes. Tell us more about what you heard from them and their reactions just to the overall news of Donald Trump being our next president.
It was a mix, and we kind of wanted to get that mix because there is a mix in Chicago.
Yes.
But overall, the worry is not even the worry, but the want is for continued funding across the board. That was the main thread between all of them that connected them. And also a connecting thread was that we want people to still continue doing the work despite whatever the government does. That shouldn't stop the work that's being done in the ground by communities and by organizations. And a lot of organizations said, if we don't get the money, we'll find a way to make the money. We'll reach out to the community. We'll do it together. Mm. So there was that resounding hopefulness still, despite whatever changes may happen and despite whatever differences politically people might have.
Dr. Zacherson, when she was mentioning her concerns, specifically said a cut to funding is going to threaten her team. What did she mean?
Yes, she has a program, and her team have a program in the University of Chicago that pairs, it's a medical legal partnership, and it pairs lawyers with the violence recovery team at the trauma center in the University of Chicago. And it allows people who have dealt with gun violence, lawyers to deal with issues like housing issues, receiving benefits, and just being able to have stability after gun violence is super important. So that's helped a lot. And the data that they have around that has shown that it has been effective. And they have funding right now through programs that are funded by this gun violence prevention money that's coming, that has been coming this following year. So,
and they don't want to lose that.
They don't want to lose it.
Yeah. And Pastor Corey Brooks doesn't believe that Trump will reduce investments. Why?
Yeah, he thinks that Trump's administration is really focused on reducing crime, and he thinks a vital part of that is investing in the communities and that have been doing this work. So he feels that that will continue.
Yeah, one of the things that the pastor mentions in your story is, quote, giving power back to our police departments and allowing them to do the work is only going to make things better for our communities, end quote.
Yes, and that goes back to the idea that a lot of community members do want more law enforcement in these areas. They want to see that presence. And again, other people have concerns over it that might lead to more incarceration, and that's maybe not the solution for some people.
That's the Trace reporter, Rita Oseguera. Thank you, Rita, for making the time. We're going to turn now to one of the Chicago leaders Rita spoke to, Veronica Ariola, 24th District Counselor for Chicago's Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, or CCPSA. Welcome back to the program.
Hi.
Good to see you. So I want to pick up where Rita left off and start with funds going to law enforcement instead of community-based programs. What are your thoughts around that?
We're really concerned that the funds being diverted from community programs and community services is going to only exacerbate violence and crime in the city. It needs to be an and with preventing violence. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, we have a lot of crime prevention, violence prevention programs that we believe are working and are using folks who had been in the incarceration system and have turned their lives around and are now trying to do the same thing on the street and preventing that violence so that the police do not have to get involved. And I think that's a win-win for everybody. If we can do that, it's actually less expensive to fund crime prevention than to fund more police officers on the street or locking people up, the judicial system. It's a very expensive process and a very traumatic process.
I want you to tell us more about that. Why would money go to law enforcement in the first place? What would an investment in policing look like?
I think the way that the Trump has been talking about crime and violence, particularly around Chicago, his favorite topic, is more incarceration. So it's just going after people who look like they're going to cause crime, loitering, and just locking people up. And the way that we have seen the switch from a a restorative justice mindset around even district attorneys, and we've gone back to, we've swung the other way, we are going to be locked. The motion is to lock more people up.
Yeah.
And so we need to be able to try to find a way to continue to fund our community groups that are going to keep people out of that system and create safer communities, a wholer communities.
Yeah. So talk more then about how a change like this would affect the CCPSA and your work.
Well, our work as district counselors is to be liaisons to the community. This is a new space for Chicago, for Chicagoans to have their own voice heard in the public safety and police accountability system. And we are, as a city, under a police decree. We are supposed to be working on police reform in a very many different directions. Mm-hmm. And this district council method is one way. So we are going to need, if we are going to be moving to a system where people are going to be more and more incarcerated, I think that it's just going to impact that way that people want to come out and talk about our communities, how to be safe. People are coming out and they want to see more patrols because people are worried. But I do believe there are. We just had a meeting a couple of months ago where we talked about some of the restorative justice courts in Cook County. And there was a huge turnout for that. And people are very interested in bringing that for that model to the 24th District on the far north side of Chicago. Because while people are scared and worried, I think there are far more people who understand that if we can nip this thing in the bud, we can stop violence from actually happening. Our communities are safer than it is to allow violence to happen and then have a police response.
Yeah, it's like almost like you have this sort of level of trust that you've got going right now between your group and the community members who are coming and having these open dialogues with you. Then if we turn to a system where more lockups are happening, for instance, people will start to
absolutely
quiet down, right? So what do we know about the impact of grassroots violence prevention programs on violence in this city?
What we know is that, as I was saying, that there are people who are, a lot of the people who are doing this violence prevention were formerly incarcerated, had been part of the system, had interactions with police. And so they know how to address young people who are thinking about going down this road.
Again, that trust.
And that trust, absolutely. And the way that some of these gangs are set up is that if somebody wants to turn their life around, they're not going to go to the police and give evidence, give testimony, but they will probably more likely trust that person that they saw growing up who is now maybe as a district counselor, has a job, they've, quote, turned their life around, and to see that there is a different path. And that's what we want to see, because that strengthens our communities. Removing people in a traumatic way from our communities only weakens us.
Are philanthropic dollars and grants not enough?
It's not enough. No, we are faced with an administration that is going to be trying to traumatize us in many different ways. And there's just not enough money in the community for us to shelter people who are now, who are experiencing homelessness, deportation, preventing violence. So much. It's just, it's too much for the community to handle on its own. We need federal funds. We need state funds. We need the governor when he says he's going to defend Illinois. And this, what it means to defend Illinois is to fund violence prevention.
Like, put your money where your mouth is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so regardless, though, this may very well be the direction that we turn to, where funds dry up with a new administration. So talk more then about anything that's being done to prepare just in case this funding does go away?
I mean, I think every community organization is preparing in their own way. We are going to prepare to continue to do our jobs and holding monthly meetings so people can look up on the CCPSA website, their district, find out when those meetings are happening mm-hmm. and get engaged. And find a way to just get engaged and lock in and see how you can help with keeping our community safe mm-hmm. and strong because we have to take care of each other.
And getting in on the forefront.
Yes,
right?
Before absolutely.
A change comes down.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll leave it there. We've been talking to Veronica Ariola, who's the 24th District Counselor for Chicago's Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. Got to get used to that, right?
Yes.
Thanks for making the time, Veronica.
Thank you.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.